19. Presences. Tossing makeup and toiletries into a bag, she noticed that the blue ant figurine wasn't there on the counter, her failed employment avoidance totem. Moved by the house cleaners in yesterday's tidy, she supposed, but unlike them. She zipped the makeup bag, checked her hair in the mirror. A voice with the BBC register was flowing smoothly, meaninglessly, from the ornate wall grid. Out past the steamy glass slabs and nickel-plate bumpers of the H.G. Wells shower, multiply towel-draped now. Glancing around number 4 in hope of finding something she might have forgotten to pack, she saw the 3 unopened cartons of the British edition of her book. Remembering Milgram, when she'd first met him, on their walk to the Tapas place, expressing interest. Big End, of course, had brought it up. Milgram had seemed taken, for a few seconds, with the idea that she'd written a book. She should take him one, she decided. She wrestled a ridiculously heavy carton onto the unmade bed and used the foil ripper on the room's Victorian corkscrew to slit the transparent plastic tape, releasing a bookstore smell as she opened the carton, but not a good one. Dry. Chemical. And there they were, square and individually shrink-wrapped, Presences, by Hollis Henry. She took one off the top, slid it into the side pocket of her rollerboard, then out, through liminal green hallways, lift and down, to the coffee-smelling foyer, where a tortoise-spectacled young man presented her with a tall white coffee in a crisp white paper cup, lidded with white plastic, and offered her a cabinet umbrella. "Is the car here?" "Yes," he said. "I won't need an umbrella, thanks." He carried the rollerboard out for her and put it in the popped trunk of a black BMW, piloted by the bearded young man who'd admitted her to Blue Ant. "Jacob," this one said, smiling. He wore a waxed cotton motorcycle jacket. It lent him a sort of post-apocalyptic elan, she thought, this rainy morning. Props should have given him a Sten gun or some other weapon looking equally like plumbing. "Of course," she said. "Thank you for picking me up. Traffic's not terrible," opening her door for her. "We're meeting Mr. Milgram?" As he slid in behind the wheel, she noted his wireless earpiece. "All sorted. Been picked up. Ready for Paris?" "I hope so," she said as he pulled away from the curb. Then Gloucester Place. Had she been walking, she'd have taken Baker Street instead, which she'd dreamed of as a child, and which retained, even at this stage of supposed adulthood, a certain small, sharp sense of disappointment. Though perhaps game was afoot in Paris, she thought, and now merely a rather long subway ride from here. In the traffic of Marylebone Road, stopping and starting, she kept noticing a dispatch rider, armored in samurai plastics, the back of his yellow helmet scarred, as if something feline and huge had swatted him and almost missed. His clumsy-looking fiberglass fairing mended with peeling silver tape.
He seemed to keep passing them somehow, rolling forward between lanes.
She'd never understood how that worked here. "I hope I can find Milgram at the station." "No fear," said Jacob. "They'll bring him to you."
Sky blue, steel-girdered vastness.
Towering volume of sound. Pigeons looking unconfused about their pigeon business. Nobody did train stations like the Europeans and the British, she thought, best of all. Faith in infrastructure, coupled with a necessity-driven gift for retrofitting. One of Big Ann's lanky, elegant drivers, hand to earpiece, hove toward her steadily through the crowd, Milgram in tow like a Sunday rowboat. Gazing around like a child, Milgram, his face lit with the boy's delight in the blue-girdered drama, the dinky toy grandeur of the great station. One of the wheels of her rollerboard began to click as she headed in their direction.